This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
Tom Wilmer reporting from Camp Roberts, U.S. Army Training Base, 12 miles north of Paso Robles. Come along and join me for a visit with Gary McMaster, chairman and curator at the Post Historical Military Museum. Camp Roberts dates from March 1941, when it commenced operations as America's largest U.S. Army basic training base. Throughout World War II, more than 436,000 infantry and field artillery troops completed 17-week basic training at the base. Camp Roberts Post Office processed more letters and packages than any other office in America, and the Post Railway Depot was the busiest of Southern Pacific's entire route. More than 9,000 construction workers were involved in building the base. Following World War II, Camp Roberts served as a basic training base for troops who served during the Korean War and Vietnam. The California National Guard assumed command of Camp Roberts in 1971, and it continues its mission of training troops from all branches of the service, as well as detachments from Allied partner countries around the world.
Gary McMaster, I've been volunteer curator of the Camp Roberts Historical Museum for 18 years now.
Excellent. Let's reel back in time. What's the history of the museum? Do you know when it was formed?
Yeah, it was formed in the early 1980s by a fellow named Al Davis, and he was a amateur historian, and he had worked as a civilian up at the Presidio of San Francisco, and did a little of their history, and then he got a job down here in the engineering department, and he had prior service in the Navy in the Korean War, and he joined the National Guard, so he was both a soldier here and a civilian worker. And he got what is now our museum annex. He got a portion of that and began a little bitty museum, and then later on, a very few years later, they gave him the Red Cross Center. And so he has those two buildings, the annex, which was originally the busiest military post office in the nation in World War II, and the Red Cross headquarters, which is now the main museum.
Camp Roberts, as I recall, was the largest training base in the United States Army during the World War II?
Yeah, it was the largest basic training camp in the entire nation. If you'd walk through that gate any time during World War II, you'd see between almost 48,000 recruits being trained, plus an army of staff, a huge army of civilian support workers working in all the offices, the PX stores. Just our laundry alone employed 1,100 civilians.
And even the surrounding communities, Bradley and a couple of the towns, they were little boom towns, weren't they?
Especially San Miguel, because the whole camp was built during the fall, winter, and spring of 1940 and 41 by 9,000 construction workers. So they were coming from all over the nation to get jobs to build this place. And, you know, San Miguel is now kind of just a shadow of its former self, but during World War II, it was just huge.
Boomtown.
Yeah, it gave a lot of growth to Paso Robles as well.
And then going forward in time, when Korean War started, this again was a training base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they deactivated at the end of World War II. During World War II, we trained almost 500,000 soldiers, and then they activated again at the outbreak of the Korean War. And during that war, we trained about 250,000 soldiers all over the United States.
So dovetailing back to the museum on base, you showcase not only the primary mission of Camp Roberts, but the military at large, correct?
Yeah, we focus on the history of Camp Roberts because we don't want to be one of those general, you know, mishmash kind of museums. So we have a definite mission to preserve and relate the history of Camp Roberts. But we also relate all the story of all the original ranches that were here, the Slending Indians and things like that that are of prominence to this property. And also we tell a little bit about Fort Hunter Liggett, which just to the north of us, which is much bigger than Camp Roberts, but originally began as maneuver area under command of Camp Roberts as well.
Oh, interesting. And Fort Ord, correct?
Yeah, Fort Ord. See, we did basic training here from 1941 until the end of the Korean War in 1953. And then we began doing a joint basic training between Fort Ord and here. So they'd be in process up there, but they'd come down here for a large portion of their basic training. And they did that from 1953, well, into the 1960s. In fact, my older brother was the one who did that.
We're in the main museum building. Mm-hmm. What was this originally?
This was the American Red Cross Center, so soldiers would come in here. We have pictures of soldiers lined up to the front door to borrow short-term loans, you know, to go home on leave. They'd make recordings to send home to their family. They'd get help with family problems and, you know, personal situations, things like that.
And you had a USO on base?
We had one in San Miguel, a really big one, and another large one in Paso Robles. So.
But there were USO presentations that took place on base, correct? And like right behind you, there's a picture of Bob Hope here.
Yeah, all the celebrities came here. In fact, we had a lot of celebrities who were drafted or enlisted and trained here. We had Robert Mitchum, William Holden, Steve Reeves, Steve Allen, Bob Newhart, Red Skelton, and in fact, Red Skelton spent all his time here. And then we had all the shows, which is virtually everyone in Hollywood. Laurel and Hardy did the first big USO show here at our Soldier Bowl. And we have a big outdoor amphitheater. It still looks just like it did during World War II. And then so Laurel and Hardy brought Phil Silvers and Sergeant Bilko. You know, he played Sergeant Bilko later on. Mickey Rooney was here, big teenage star. There was so much talent in every area. I mean, we had the professional newspaper people, journalists that were here to do our camp newspaper. We had professional athletes here to help with the sports programs like baseball and basketball and so forth. Joe Lewis would go around to all the different camps, and we have pictures of him refereeing boxing matches at the Soldier Bowl, sparring in the big gymnasium across the street that's been renovated. And, we had everybody here.
In post-World War II, in the last 20 years or so, there have been some Hollywood movies that have used Camp Roberts as a film location. Can you think of one? Remember one?
Well, the court-martial of Jackie Robinson was filmed here. There was a couple other movies that were filmed here. See Here, Private Hargrove. We had, there was a famous, at the time, movie called Follow the Boys. It was a Universal Studios' big patriotic production. During World War II, every movie studio, at least one big patriotic movie with all their contract players, and some of that was filmed here. In fact, at the end, you can see Donald O'Connor and people jumping off a cargo truck at the Soldier Bowl and going on stage and putting on a show with George Raft looking from the wings. And We Were Soldiers Once, the Mel Gibson movie from 10 years ago or so. That was filmed at Hunter Liggett, but a lot of the extras stayed in their barracks down here. Cool. But Bob Hope would come, and he would do some TV here. He did radio shows with Jane Russell, a lot of other people.
Well, let's talk specifics about the museum and what somebody could experience here. What are the first things that you would show us when we walked around?
Well, the first thing I usually show is the history of our namesake, Corporal Harold W. Roberts. And he was lost his life in the Argonne Offensive, World War One, in 1918 in France. He was from San Francisco, kind of a local guy. And he was 22 when he died. And he was the second tank crewman ever to receive the Medal of Honor. He was in the cavalry in the Philippines, and they got mobilized and sent over to France in the war. And we didn't need a lot of mounted cavalry where we were. One, it was trench warfare. But we had a tank corps, and he went into the tank corps. We had these we used these little French tanks made by Renault, and they were, and he and his gunner in the Argonne Offensive were assisting another tank, and their tank eventually slid into a huge artillery crater filled with about 10 feet of water. And as the water was rushing in before they both drowned, as he was drowning, he pushed his fellow crewmate out to safety, so he was awarded the Medal of Honor. All military installations are normally named after generals, but I guess Congress felt that this place was so big and important they wanted to name it after somebody that the trainees could better relate to. Put Robert's life together in a biography for the museum as a fundraiser, and started sending flowers to his grave every Memorial Day. So I've been doing that for 12 or 13 years. And I was at his grave last October for the 100th anniversary of his death.
A little bit more about the museum itself.
Well, here's one of our famous trainees. There, in 1941, Caspar Weinberger, he went on to become Secretary of Defense, of course, under President Reagan. He was one of our early trainees in 41. We have his son and daughter donated his World War II uniform, this jacket above. He used to wear as Secretary of Defense when he'd go visit troops, his medals, a Bible he carried with him throughout the war. And this is a reconstruction of a field set up for inspection. This tells a little bit about the first time the Army came to this area, which was 1902, and they were looking for to build a camp to train a regiment of cavalry. And there were conflicting stories about how bad the area was as far as water and that, and they decided not to, but then they came back in 1940 when Congress wanted three more basic training camps. They wanted one in California, so they came back here and decided this is a perfect place, halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles, not far from the ocean.
And rail service.
Yeah, exactly. We have a spur that comes into our warehouse area. In fact, this locomotive over here was the one that moved the cars from the main line up the spur through the lines of warehouses to drop stuff off and pick stuff up. And we never even dreamed that that was not scrapped after the war. But the San Luis Obispo Railroad Museum actually found that a couple of years ago, and they bought it. It was up north at some, had been used at different businesses, and they fixed it up, repainted it, and that's on display down there. So that was quite a deal. This exhibit shows the Korean War period with the soldier on his bunk and all his, you know, his locker with his uniforms and all that. Gotten all the newspapers that they made during World War II and the Korean War, and all these Camp Roberts trainers are kind of like yearbooks, and we've gone to great lengths to find those on eBay, and some were donated as we try to bring all that history back. These big paintings on either side of the room were our romanticized versions of, you know, scenes of old California, and they were painted by a soldier artist here during the Korean War. We have maps here that show all the original barracks and what training companies were in there. So when we have fellows that come back that were here during World War II or the Korean War, we can ID where those barracks were if they knew what, remember what unit they were in. A little on the Nacimiento Ranch. We have almost 43,000 acres here, and most of it was the Nacimiento Ranch, which was an original Spanish land grant. And then we had about four smaller ranches here that the government leased it all up and finally bought it when they started construction. Aerial photographs, too, of the camp that show you what it looked like when we had all 1,050 buildings.
How many buildings remain today?
We have about a third of the original buildings, and they've all been modernized. This is all World War II training shown in this hallway. In this room here, we have Vietnam, when they were still doing basic training early Vietnam period here. This is on our first National Guard units that were sent to Iraq, and they brought back things to us like pieces from Saddam Hussein's Babylon Palace, and we have a lot of unique things like pieces of the Berlin Wall. And then we have our Korean War room, and this is all on training here during the Korean War. And we have copies of a lot of the yearbooks that they had for the different units that were training here. This is a kind of an interesting thing. You know, when they were tearing down a lot of the old buildings that hadn't been used in decades, several years ago, they started finding some wallets in the floorboards and the walls. They came up with about 30, and wow, they've all been turned into, you know, the families have been tracked down and they've been given to them. In some cases, the soldiers were still alive, and these two that we have left, we've never been able to find the owners to. But evidently, a soldier would get up during the middle of the night, go steal somebody's wallet, take all the money out, ditch the wallet, so it still had the cards or photos, everything in it. So,
living history.
Yeah, we had that, was in the L.A. Times and Good Morning America. And we have a little sign-in books for our World War II and Korean War veterans as well.
Who typically comes to the museum, and how do people find out about
it? Well, we get a lot of travelers. Is there a poster in the Camp Roberts rest stop? We have a huge website with a, it actually has a virtual tour on it, too. It's CampRobertsHistoricalMuseum.com. A real big website, very interesting. Everyone should check that out. We have our brochures that we have at all the other museums and historical societies and different RV parks and things like that. We'd like the word to go out a lot more. We can't, you know, we don't get any government funding, so we do all this on donations, a membership program, and proceeds from the gift shop. So we can't do a lot of ads because, you know, that's hundreds of dollars each time.
The process of a civilian coming on base to go to the museum is pretty easy.
It's pretty easy, yeah. They only need their regular driver's license if they're driving, and plus their insurance and registration. You know, people forget to carry their insurance card. Sometimes you have to have those. Everyone, even if they're not driving, has to have a driver's license or DMV ID or government ID. It's free.
One of the coolest things is your annex where you have a lot of static displays. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the things that you think are coolest.
Well, we have a big room, and a lot of that room is on all the live shows they did with MGM people and Soldier Talent and Red Skelton. We have our big Iraq and Afghanistan exhibits. We have an exhibit on our prisoners of war. We had both Italian and German POWs here during World War II. We have a lot of restored World War II vehicles inside. We have the original guardhouse from the front gate that was out there from World War II, so 1941 all the way until about 10 years ago. We took it back to what it looked like during the Korean War and have MPs in it. We have a big D-Day exhibit, an exhibit on Operation Just Cause. We have a lot of big selection of different radios. And we have a big exhibit on SATCOM, which is our huge satellite station here at Camp Roberts that goes back to the early 1960s. Recently put together an exhibit on UAVs, you know, commonly called drones, unmanned aerial vehicles. And we're always adding to that. We're putting a control station in there with mannequins, and it's got audio, visual.
And you have some helicopters.
We have an attack helicopter, a Cobra. We have a Kiowa helicopter, three main battle tanks, a M-47, a M-48 Patton. They're both Patton tanks. And we have a Walker Bulldog. We have a combat engineer vehicle, two or three self-propelled howitzers, some armored personnel carriers, some anti-aircraft guns. We have a prototype Bradley from... They've done a lot of Bradley testing here over the years, so a lot of vehicles. And one thing that's unique about this place, you can actually go inside the tanks and the self-propelled howitzers and the helicopters, which you can't do anywhere else that I know of.
So kids must love that one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we also have an area where kids can try on different uniforms from different eras and different countries. And, yeah, they love that.
So as Camp Roberts evolved over time, this became a California National Guard base, one of the prime ones in the mm-hmm. state, correct?
Yeah, during all the time that the camp was not activated for like World War II or the Korean War, it was a site for reserve training. Then in 1971, it actually was formally given over to the California Army National Guard as its main training and pre-deployment site. So when guard units get sent overseas, they come through here, and then they go to an active Army installation, then they go overseas. They come back the same way.
And you have an airfield here that's active today?
We have an airfield on East Garrison on the other side of the highway that where they stage helicopters. We have McMillan Airfield out in the training areas that's used and they actually have a National Guard Armory out there, too. That's where our UAV testing and training goes on. So there's a picture of 12,000 men about to pass in review on the parade field. This is where we are up here. This is our huge parade field. The main site for the guard from armies all over California, we have all the components, regular and active, that train here. We have regular Army Special Ops and Airborne. We have Marine Corps Reserve. We have Navy SEALs and Seabees. The British Reserves and Salisbury Plain and Southern Wales are usually here most of the year to do UAV training. We get other nations that come here. We just had the Guam National Guard here not long ago. Guards from other states as well as Army Reserve, and everybody comes there.
Very interesting, because from Highway 101 driving by, you'd never know.
Mostly you just see part of the cantonment area, which is a build-up area where people sleep. But, you know, we have almost 48,000 acres where all the ranges and everything is, all the different training areas. So that's where they are during the day. They come back, sleep at night, or maybe they sleep out there too. So you don't see too much in the cantonment area during the day.
And a moment about you, Gary. What's your background in military?
I was in the Army, regular Army first in 1965. I went to basic at Fort Polk, and I was with Yukon Command and the Arctic Test Center. Later on, I was an amphibious operator in the Army Reserve, and then I went over to the National Guard full-time as a unit administrator for a tank company, then a mechanized infantry brigade. And so I was went to school, became a nuclear biological chemical NCO. And then later on, when I went to another tank battalion, I went to another school and learned to drive all kinds of different trucks and that, and became the truck master for the tank battalion. Then they transferred me here in 1997, and I was the security NCO for the camp, and I also was an operations NCO that would check in units and put them on ranges and things like that.
And you retired at what rank?
I was an E7, Sergeant First Class, and then I was, I retired in 03, and then I was a contractor here for another 8 years as a civilian. And then I got roped in by Al Davis, the start of the museum, a little after I got here, and I said, Al, you should have a membership program, and you need a brochure. And he said, well, I started the brochure, and he showed me some written notes. I said, I'm going to come down during lunch and get some photos. And I put together the first brochure for the museum.
Tell us about the train station here at Camp Roberts.
Well, originally when they were building Camp Roberts, they brought all the lumber in at the San Miguel train station. Then later in 1941, they built our own train station. And it wasn't very big, but it was actually the busiest stop on the Southern Pacific Route for a while. And you see, we have pictures. We actually have model train layout of the railroad station with Highway 101 there and the train coming through. So you can, all you model railroad enthusiasts would like to see that. And then we have, this is all an exhibit on the mess halls and the field mess, you know. During World War II, the Army bakers, in addition to baking everything else, every morning they had to wake up and bake 6,000 loaves of bread. Can you imagine feeding like almost 48,000 troops?
Were there African American soldiers stationed here?
They did. You know, World War II, you know, the military was still segregated, and they had African American troops over on East Garrison. I wanted to do an exhibit on it because it's a very important part of our history. Unfortunately, there's very little mention in any of the newspapers, just a little bit here and there.
You know, photos?
Newspapers. What's that?
Any photos, archival photos?
A couple is all, yeah, very little. We'd love, if there's anybody out there, if your dad or grandfather or uncle or any of your relatives was part of any of those groups and you have photos, we would love for you to be able to share those. And you can go to our website and get our contact information, our emails and our phone numbers, and we'd love to get more of that. That's one of my goals, to do that. You see, here at the Maine Museum, the street in front, New Mexico Avenue, everything south of that was the Infantry Field Artillery Training Center. Everything north and over on East Garrison on the other side of the highway was the Field Artillery Replacement Training Center. They each had a big band, and in fact, Jack Cathcart, the brother-in-law of Judy Garland, who used to come here and entertain, he was the band leader of infantry one, I believe. And then this is an exhibit on our civilians, all the civilian workers here. As we had, you know, the commissary here, the post office workers, the PX workers, the laundry and dry cleaning workers.
And once again,
civilian personnel branch.
During World War II, roughly how many civilians were employed here?
Oh, gosh. It's in the thousands. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly how many, but several thousand. And then we had Women's Army Corps here, too. They had barracks, and their area was just to the south of the parade ground. I'm not sure how many, but it was a detachment, probably a couple of hundred of those, too. Also, we had a huge Army hospital here. So a lot of the time, well, first of all, it was more than 90 buildings. It was huge. They were all one-story buildings. A lot of them were connected with screened-in
walkways,
yeah, where they could take people in wheelchairs and gurneys and stuff from one building to the next. A lot of times when celebrities like Marlene Dietrich or Judy Garland, people like that came, they would also, as well as doing their show, they'd go visit all our patients at the hospital. So it's...
During World War II, one group of unsung heroes was the 442, the Japanese Nisei soldiers. And I understand that some of them trained here.
Yeah, and again, we don't have much information. We have a couple of photos. I did put together a booklet on the pictures and the little general information I could find on them, and also the Filipino, 1st Filipino Infantry Regiment, also, that did most of their training at Camp San Luis Obispo, but we understand they did do some training here, too. Interesting thing about that, when I told you Caspar Weinberger did his basic training here, well, he was on leave up in the Bay Area to visit family when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Of course, everybody was called back, and he came back, and he got a ride and walked in the main gate, and the first person he saw was a Japanese Nisei soldier on guard duty, and it scared the bejesus out. He thought they took over already. Also, during World War II, we had our own rodeo every year. Gabby Hayes and Gene Autry would come and be master of ceremonies. So it was a ranch-type rodeo, and there's a land navigation range there right now. It's just over Headquarters Hill. So you'd see the hundreds and hundreds of people that would come to get stock from Fresno and different places and bring it in. And a lot of the soldiers lived on ranches, and they would participate in the rodeo. So it was a very, very popular event every year. And these are pictures down here of the soldier bull, which it still looks like this. And they would have 20 to 22,000 soldiers sitting on the natural.
So that's an outdoor amphitheater auditorium.
Yep. The museum's open every Thursday and every Saturday to the general public. A lot of the other times we do events. We have soldier groups that come through here, or civilian clubs that we give, organizations that we give special tours to. So if anyone has a civic club or any kind of veterans organization or anything like that, of like 20 more people, we'd be glad to host them on any day of the week.
Good to know. Gary McMaster, Chairman and Curator at Camp Roberts Historical Museum. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you, and please check out our website, CampRobertsHistoricalMuseum.com.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Camp Roberts, California. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolff, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust preservation initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.